This episode is brought to you by Bombas. Summer's here and we're all chasing something. Maybe it's a break, a goal, a vibe. Well, let's not let bad socks and blisters ruin it. I know in my household, we are not letting that happen because my wife and I love Bombas socks. In fact, it's pretty much all we wear right now because they are such a step up in quality from your usual socks. They are comfortable, they are soft, they are functional, they're not going to fall down during the day, so you have to keep pulling them up. And guess what? They look good too, so maybe you want to look stylish for a wedding. It's wedding season. Well, Bombas has great stuff that's going to make you the best dressed guest. And if you're a runner like Paul, well, Bombas running socks, they wick sweat, they help keep you cool and fight blisters, but they also make specialized pairs for tennis, golf, hiking, you name it. And of course, we all love Bombas Mission, where one pair purchased equals one donated to someone who needs it. Head over to bombas.com and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com, code CURB at checkout. Bombas.com and use the code CURB. Hey, listeners, it's 2024 and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, I'm off to see the world's biggest gland.
Tell me more.
England.
That's not bad. Matt, were you in prison a naughty skeleton?
I don't know.
In a rib cage. And then what I like, that doesn't make any sense, but it's kind of grim. Did you hear, Matt, about the skeleton that was almost picked apart by a pack of wild dogs?
I did not hear.
He merrily escaped. No, that one didn't do it for you.
I like Marilee. Yeah, that's good. It's clever.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Moore Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. Tonight, we had a great discussion with Dr. Lindsay Kuo about hyperparathyroidism, which, Paul, this is a topic we covered a couple years ago on the show, but this one definitely different than the previous episode we did. And we got advice from somebody who takes these glands out and deals with, you know, because that's always one of the vexing things for us in primary care is like, when do you take the glands out? Like, what's the workup that needs to be done? What's my role as primary care? So she had a lot of great answers, very practical knowledge for us here. And I think we lived up to what we do on the show, Paul, which I think you still need to tell the audience.
Masterful segue, Matt. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Tonight, we had, as you allude to, Dr. Lindsay Kuo. Dr. Kuo is an endocrine surgeon, and she tells us a little bit about what that actually means and what that entails. There's a period in the episode where she's actually going through what the parathyroid surgery looks like, and it's just every so often I get to tell us the surgeons where she's like, oh, yeah, and then I cured the patient in 20 minutes, which is not something I get to say possibly ever. But Dr. Kuo is a high-volume endocrine surgeon. She specializes in surgery of the thyroid, parathyroid, and adrenal glands. She received her medical degree from the Feinberg School of Medicine, completed residency training at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and completed a fellowship in endocrine surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She regularly treats benign amyloid conditions, including Graves' disease, complex thyroid cancer, primary hyperparathyroidism, the topic of this episode, and hyperfunctioning adrenal masses. In this episode, we talk about all the run-in up to surgery for primary hyperparathyroidism, but also what the differential looks like for that. We talk a little bit about this normal calcemic primary hyperparathyroidism, which Matt and I agree is infuriating, and then some other variations on that theme. So a lot of this will be practice changing for me, and very much enjoyed talking to Dr. Kuo about her approach to the patient with an elevated calcium. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't yet done so, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes. I think we have close to 30 of them now out there. Plus, you can get ad-free episodes and a whole bunch of other cool stuff like access to our Cashlack vault at patreon.com/curbsiders. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us on the show. The audience has heard your bio, but they want to know a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine.
I recently got very into credit card points. And I feel like when I talk about them, I sound like a salesperson, but it literally is my new hobby. It's something I can do on my own, get my husband to do it too, but I can kind of take ownership. I enjoy it. There's actually, for any of the women out there, there's a great female physician oriented Facebook group. And there's also a podcast, all about it. And it's let us book a lot of great trips actually, in really nice seats going places far, far away. So that's my new hobby.
Paul, we're going to have to cancel the show and just go dig into this for the next hour.
We can do another one.
I have so when you say do it, does that just mean spend money on a credit card that has good points, or what does that look like?
It just means maximizing the points we get off of any like spending that we're putting on our credit card. Because different cards have different like points that you get for doing various things. And then there's like sign up bonuses that you get and you like spend a certain amount in a certain amount of time. So we just put a bunch of taxes on a credit card and got a bunch of points.
Well, and so are you, I know this is not the show, but so are you like card hopping then? Like, so then you see another card and you're like, well, this looks fantastic.
Yeah, there's
and
a lot of, to that card. There's a lot of like adding so still to the collection at the moment, this moment. Not a lot of taking away. So I'm not churning so much as I am just gaining more. The two of us though, so it feels less like it's just me, but
sure,
mostly
it's a couple's thing. That's sweet. Okay.
He willingly does what I tell him.
is there a resource if the audience is interested in this, which I imagine many of them will be, what is a good starting resource to dig into this world?
Fantastic question. The Point Me to First Class podcast is run by a female pathologist. I don't believe she's clinically active anymore, but it is a podcast. It's downloadable on the usual podcast places, and it's a really great podcast. It goes into a lot of the different topics like week by week. So.
And it's a great name, Point Me to First Class. That's great. Yeah.
We probably should cut that out. I don't think recommending rival podcasts is wise. Fascinating. All right. Well, that was not where I expected this to go.
Paul found a new hobby.
Yeah, maybe. I have like a credit card, which apparently I'm a fool.
I mean, I only got into this a year ago, so, or less than that. So there's still so much time.
I did want to ask Lindsay, I'm going to pitch a softball question. You are an endocrine surgeon, which just feels extraordinarily niche. I'm not entirely sure I understand exactly what that is. Can you tell our audience exactly what your day-to-day looks like and how maybe even you got interested in that in the first place?
Yeah, you're right. It is a very niche specialty, and it's something that has really grown in the last 20 to 25 years. An endocrine surgeon can come from a variety of different training backgrounds. I am a general surgeon initially by training pathway, and then I did an endocrine surgery fellowship after that. So general surgery to endocrine surgery fellowship, general surgery to surgical oncology, and then also otolaryngology can become endocrine surgeons. It simply means that I focus on taking care of conditions related to the thyroid, the parathyroid, and also for me as a general surgeon based, the adrenal glands. So I do benign, I do malignant, I do evaluations for these things, but these are the only operations I do, and by and large, the only patients I see. Some people will be doing some other things as part of their practice, but an endocrine surgeon is somebody who has basically chosen to specialize in these three organ systems.
It feels like I mean, this is a compliment, I promise. You almost have to have a little bit of a medicine mindset, I would think, to be interested in that. I would love to, like, how did you find that as a particular passion?
You know, I actually really loved endocrinology as a medical student, but internal medicine was just not for me. And I happened to go to a residency program where there are two incredibly high volume endocrine surgeons. And that's where I really got exposed to it. And I really do, you're right, love the medicine part of it because I can really think about the downstream effects of exactly what I do. vascular surgeons will just be like, oh, I'm a plumber and all that stuff. And which is, you know, everyone has their sort of little niche of the way they approach or why they like what they do. And for me, I really do love the medicine aspect of it because that's, I like thinking about things. Like everything has like a sort of logical response that you or predictable response in terms of somebody's hormone levels, et cetera.
Yeah, I would say as a medical student, I was telling you off air, I got to watch a lot of endocrine surgeries because there was a great endocrine surgeon at my medical school. And it was pretty cool. It made me think about going into surgery, but too much of a medicine nerd. So I just had, you got to be with your people, right? So that's why I ended up in internal medicine.
And I think endocrine surgeons, and again, we come from a variety of different training backgrounds, but endocrine surgeons all really have a very medicine-y approach to things. We really love collaborating with endocrinologists, also, you know, oftentimes primary care physicians and others we work with. But at our most recent meeting, the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons, we had a joint session with the Endocrine Society, because I think these are things that we all find collectively very interesting. And rather than being sort of siloed into just taking something out, thinking about how do you really care for that patient before and afterwards is, I think, the biggest part of what we do and what makes us differentiates us from other people who maybe don't really do this these operations as much or think about these problems in the same way.
Before we start talking about hyperparathyroidism, I just wanted to ask any advice or feedback that you've gotten along the way in your career or training that you wanted to share with our listeners.
I guess it's so like two sort of pieces of advice, one of which was sort of a very direct piece of advice and one of which was sort of like watching somebody else do this by example. And I guess the direct one was really that one of my mentors in fellowship, who he was also a surgeon, he had a number of young kids. I, in my fellowship, had a 6-month-old and I did not really know what attending life would look like as a surgeon, as a parent. And he was like, watching him sort of build his schedule week to week. So it's very different for surgeons because you have your OR days, you'll have your clinic days, you'll have an admin day. But he said that Tuesdays, which was his admin day, he was going to take his daughter to school every day. And he was going to make sure that every Tuesday he did that. And that's not what I do necessarily, but I make sure I have carved out some things that I'm going to be doing. And it also made me feel like, look, here's honestly a male surgeon who's doing this. And I can feel comfortable to do that as a female surgeon. So that was one thing, because I think, you know, especially as we think about, you know, work-life balance, trying to find the small ways that we can make sure we are being the whole people that we want is really important. And the other sort of thing I saw by example is that every surgeon is going to make mistakes at times. And I'm sure you guys have all had patients who've had complications from one surgery or another, and everyone's going to make mistakes. And I remember having a complication earlier on in my career and talking to a senior mentor about this, and they were just so thoughtful and understanding and knew that I was in some ways grieving. And I was also very supportive of that. But I was like, okay, we're going to have to put it back together. We have to keep going. And so having the grace and empathy to support somebody through that was really important, because it makes you realize that, again, we're all human, especially as surgeons. We're all going to make mistakes, as much as we maybe sometimes deny them or want to deny them. But I think just watching that senior person who could have taken a very different approach to that interaction was really instructive.
Yeah, the mistakes or the complications from surgeon, they just seem like they would be so tough to handle. I know any mistakes, like it's always as like the rest of medicine, you can know and be like, oh, that was someone else's fault. It's not as obvious as if you had anything to do with a bad thing that happened. But as a surgeon, I feel like you really put yourself out there. So I could see that being a tough thing. All right, Paul. Well, I think we need to get to a case now because we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, so let's talk about Ms. Jones, one of my very inventively named patients. So Ms. Jones is a 54-year-old woman. She comes to us with a past medical history of high blood pressure, prediabetes, obesity with a BMI of 31, and anxiety. She presents to her primary care clinician's office for routine follow-up. She is on hydrochlorothiazide 25 milligrams, escitalopram 10 milligrams, and atorvastatin 20 milligrams. She has been rock solid, stable, and boring. But despite this, we decide to check a bunch of labs anyway. And upon review of her labs, her calcium level, we note, has been slightly elevated for the past 2 years. So it's been anywhere between 10.3 and 10.6, enough. So, Lindsay, I don't know if you know this, but the Williams rule is if you see an abnormal lab, you just keep rechecking it until you like the numbers. But in her case, it just didn't get better and kind of stayed where it was. So, and you note in each progress note, you're like, I'm going to repeat that calcium level, just hoping that it's going to normalize, and then it doesn't. And not much workup has been done beyond this. So before we kind of take Ms. Williams on her journey, I feel like in medical school, we get drilled in like the common causes of hypercalcemia. And it's almost like church, where you sort of repeat things back. So it's going to be primary hyperparathyroidism malignancy. But just for form's sake, can you talk us through, if you hear about a patient like this, what initial differential do you think about for a patient with hypercalcemia?
So, I mean, I, of course, think about primary hyperparathyroidism because that's what I always want it to be. But other things you have to think about are what medications is she on, and could any of these be increasing her serum calcium? Any patient of this age, you also have to wonder about a hypercalcemia due to malignancy. And I would say the duration of her hypercalcemia kind of speaks against that in this particular patient. But those are the sort of three things I really, you know, would want to make sure are sort of evaluated and ruled out before I jump to any conclusions.
Yeah, Paul, you always have to recheck because like you always see the calcium that's like 10.4 and you're like, were you dehydrated? And then, you know, right. You check it again. So there's so many potential reasons for that. I like how you're excited about primary hyperparathyroidism. I usually have the opposite. I'm like, I hope this isn't primary hyperparathyroidism because then I have to do a lot more stuff for the patient, but like maybe even refer to you eventually. So tell us about any other things that we should be doing for this patient as a primary care, like when we're seeing this, the person come in with these labs. We do the Williams method. Let's say it's still 10.6.
Yeah, I think anytime the calcium is at or above the upper limit of normal multiple times, especially over multiple time periods, I think that's a time to be concerned about this. And even if on occasion it dips down to just being under the upper limit of normal, I think it's really important to recognize that in and of itself, that's still not normal, even if it's in with the normal range. And so I think checking with, you know, a PTHRP and reviewing their medication list, those are all the things I would do. And if their PTH is elevated, then that's most likely what's going to be is primary hyperparathyroidism. If it's not elevated and if it's suppressed, and by suppressed, I mean below the normal range for PTH, then it's really a thing to start thinking about other causes of their hypercalcemia.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All depends in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your soap notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient's instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, it takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai, and listeners of Curbsiders can use code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. Folks, as part of this job, I spend a lot of time staring and swearing at computer screens. So I might be talking about a Canva file that I uploaded into a Google Doc, and we're having a conversation about that in our Slack channel. And then I might gently cry myself to sleep at night. And because I write across multiple platforms and multiple places during my workday, it's important to me to deliver consistent, high-quality communication. And at least with Grammarly, I can help do that. So Grammarly is this AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with high-quality writing for better projects, proposals, presentations, and more. They allow you to work efficiently and effectively so that you can stare a little bit less at the computer screens over the course of your day. We use a lot of different platforms to do our writing to prepare for the show, and with Grammarly, I can use these to police my own tone. Grammarly can give you prompts for actually writing ideas. I can make sure that I'm writing concisely and effectively so that I can get my ideas across. And better writing means a stronger impact. About 96% of Grammarly users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. It works across 500,000 apps and websites. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, your goals, and your context, and can even help with tone, which Lord knows is something that I struggle with. If all that sounds appealing to you, and well, it should, get AI writing support that works where you work. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. And Lindsay, you mentioned medications a couple of times. What are the big culprits that are commonly prescribed that we should be mindful of?
Thiazide diuretics are by and far the biggest one. Lithium also, but that's much more of a sort of niche situation and less common and also less easy to sort out. The thiazide diuretics are definitely very common. They can cause mild hypercalcemia because, you know, that's sort of what they do, is they try to prevent people from urinating out their calcium. And so the way to sort of address this, if you're not sure if it could be the thiazide diuretic or it could just be primary hyperparathyroidism, is to actually hold their thiazide diuretic for about 3 months and obviously give them something else as they need for their other conditions. But hold the thiazide for about 3 months, let it wash out, and then repeat your labs.
Yeah, that's way longer than I would have thought you had to hold it for.
I know. But the other thing is, I think what's really important to realize is that the way the PTH works is that if your calcium is elevated, your PTH should be suppressed because you don't really need it as much to be maintaining a eucalcemic state. So if your PTH is super elevated and your calcium is also elevated, even if they're on the thiazide diuretic, it's still probably just primary hyperparathyroidism. Sometimes people ask, is this because I'm taking a calcium supplement or am I just eating too much cheese? And it's very unlikely to be solely because of dietary intake or even a significant amount of calcium supplementation.
I do feel like cheese-related hypercalcemia would be a write-up. I think that's at least a poster at a local
conference. I know, but patients always are like, should I stop eating calcium? And the important thing is, and we can talk about all this stuff later, but the important thing is that no, they should continue on their normal dietary supplements and eat their normal things, because none of that is really going to solve the problem or really make it much worse.
So, Paul, are we ready for the next part of the case?
Sure. So we repeat the calcium, as is our way, but this time around, we actually are a little bit more complete. We decide to check an ionized calcium. We check an intact PTH. We check a vitamin D level, because we read we're supposed to do that. The serum calcium comes back at 10.6. The albumin is in the normal range, but we're not correcting anymore because we learned that that's actually not as good as checking an ionized calcium.
Mm-hmm.
See prior episodes. And her vitamin D, 25-hydroxy, is 20 nanograms per milliliter. Her intact PTH is 107.6 nanograms per milliliter. So elevated is the point that I would make here. So here we have a patient who has elevated calcium, elevated PTH. So we feel fairly comfortable saying this is probably, I'm still doing a whole lot of hedging because I'm an internist, probably primary hyperparathyroidism. What should we do about this low vitamin D level? Is this anything related to it? Is this one of those things where you gently repeat? Ever since I started reading about this, I started to go into panic that I'm going to just worsen something by repleting vitamin D. So how does that fit into this picture, and what do we do with that information?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the 25-hydroxy vitamin D is typically going to be on the low side, whether or not it's at the low end of normal or even slightly lower than that in patients with primary hyperparathyroidism. And that's because the PTH molecule helps convert hydroxy, so 25-OH vitamin D, to dihydroxy, 125-OH vitamin D. And so that mechanism, by having extra parathyroid hormone, means that level is always going to be on the low side. These patients can get repleted a little bit. And I believe some of the Fifth International Workup guidelines do recommend repleting to at least 30 to 50. I think this patient said she was 20. You know, I think some people, they say that you should do that to really just confirm the diagnosis. But honestly, if a patient's really hypercalcemic, despite a vitamin D deficiency, it's probably not a vitamin D deficiency. I think that's really more important if you're talking about one of the variants of primary hyperparathyroidism called normal calcemic, which we can discuss in a moment or two. But I do think that there is some data that shows that repletion of your vitamin D to at least 30-ish will help mitigate some postoperative hypocalcemia after a parathyroidectomy.
Yeah, this was potentially practice changing for me, Paul, because usually if I find someone with hypercalcemia or I think they might have primary hyperparathyroidism, I'm telling them to stop their calcium and vitamin D supplements. But it sounds like once you know they have primary hyperparathyroidism, the guidelines all still say, especially if they're going for surgery, that they should still take the Institute of Medicine recommended, which is for younger men and women, 800 milligrams of calcium a day, or 1,000 if they're older men and women, and then the vitamin D, as we just talked about, of 30 to 50, which is kind of counterintuitive. But for me, that's practice changing. So I need to, once I know it's primary hyperparathyroidism, I'll need to get people to just go back on their supplementation if they need it.
Yeah, it's really counterintuitive. But I mean, that's what our expert guidelines say. So it's hard to go against that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like I've e-consulted endocrinology more than once about this, and their answer is invariably yes, but just go easy. And I'm like, okay, so noted. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask, actually, to go back for a second about PTH testing specifically. Any particular testing considerations we should bear in mind before? I think that's one of the ones. I know the ionized calcium, I think, has to be on ice, which so I always get a little bit tripped up by that and sort of where to send patients practically from where I'm practicing. But anything else we should be mindful of? I know biotin can interfere with the thyroid function test, but I think that I read it can even interfere with the PTH test. Is there anything else that we should be mindful of before just firing off the test?
No, I would just send it. And I think, you know, if there's any question or concern, I would always repeat it, even if it is elevated, because having multiple elevated PTHs with concurrent calcium levels is really important. And I do want to raise that, is that the levels need to be drawn at the same time or, the same day, because if you draw one day and you draw another 3 days later, those could both represent normal physiologic swings in somebody's baseline levels. So having them done at the same time is really crucial. So again, a calcium, PTH, if calcium is concerning for you're not sure about your, like if it truly is elevated or not, the ionized, as you mentioned, is a really great way to go as well. But concurrent levels is the really important part.
And with the biotin, Paul, you mentioned that because we talked about this on the thyroid, on a previous thyroid show, that they recommend holding it for 48 hours before someone gets like thyroid testing, because that can make people look like they have Graves. I didn't realize it also affected the PTH level. So the audience might remember that from our thyroid episode.
Okay. So we still like our working diagnosis. We still like primary hyperparathyroidism, in part because that's the title of this episode. So now that we have the working diagnosis and we have the patient in front of us, what sort of questions should we be asking? Because a lot of the times I feel like this comes up incidentally because we're fussing around with the numbers and the patients aren't even really, like it's just something they're not even aware that we're working on. But now that we have the diagnosis, what history is going to be important to the patient?
So I always want to know if the patient is symptomatic. And symptomatic in this case has a really narrow definition according to the NIH. Back in the 50s and 60s and, obviously before that, these cases were all identified fairly late in the disease because people weren't getting regular lab testing. So people often, when they had this problem, typically presented with bad kidney stones or significant bony complications. So those are the two things that are quote unquote symptomatic according to the NIH. So I always want to know, does a patient have kidney stones? Has a patient had any recent fractures? Do they have osteoporosis? But then I also want to know a lot about their other symptoms that can be secondary to their hyperparathyroidism, because that helps me understand as a surgeon, how does the patient feel? How can I maybe make them better? Sometimes they say that absolutely nothing is wrong, and then that actually just changes how I have to interact with them in terms of counseling. But it's, for me, I start to ask a whole litany of questions, and it really does follow what you learn in medical school about stones, bones, groans, psychiatric overtones, although those are a little bit different than what people may think of. So what I will ask a patient is, I really go through it, stones, bones, groans. Do you have kidney stones? Do you urinate a lot? Are you thirsty? Because polyuria and polydipsia can be a part of this sequelae of symptoms. I ask, about the fractures. I ask also about bone pain, because some patients with chronic longstanding disease can have aches in their bones, not their joints, but it's an aching pain in the bones. I ask also about muscle weakness. Oftentimes these patients just feel very weak. I ask about abdominal pain, constipation, reflux, just because oftentimes these patients will have peptic ulcer disease, they can have pancreatitis, or even just some chronic crampy pain. Some patients are very constipated due to the hypercalcemia. So it's stones, bones, groans. And then the psychiatric overtones, again, I think a lot of people just may think that that's a patient who might just be a little kooky or odd. But really, there's a whole range of potentially psychiatric effects that the data has not necessarily shown that there's significant associations per se. But in experience, I can have a patient sitting in front of me who has every single thing that I ask them. But significant fatigue is oftentimes a part of this. Fatigue that can be just, okay, well, I just am tired. I feel like I work a lot. I have young kids, all the way up to I can't get out of bed. I ask about headaches. I ask about mood changes, because oftentimes people have a little bit of a dysphoric mood. People have a lot of short-term memory problems, like you walk into a room and you forget why you went in there, or you put something down, you forget where you put it. I had one patient not too long ago, tell me she would be driving in a car and she would forget where she was going. Like she just all of a sudden was like, why am I in this car? Which is also horrifying. They can't concentrate. They feel like their mind is in a fog. I had a patient who is very public about the fact that I operated on her. She's a nurse. And so she would work nights. And so she realized she was having more and more difficulty doing crosswords at night, which is what she would do in between doing things, to, you know, just to keep herself alert and engaged. And she realized she was having trouble focusing. And finally, when she realized she forgot how to do ACLS, that's when she was like, no, something is not right. Yeah. This is an ER nurse too. She's like, no, something's not right. And they kind of pushed her doctors actually to get it sorted out. So these are all the things that people can have. And sometimes people say, nope, I feel fine. Sometimes people literally, I had a woman last week who told me, said yes to literally everything that I asked. And it's really hard to know which of these non-specific symptoms is due solely to the hypercalcemia and the hyperparathyroidism or something else. And I do tell patients that. I can't know for sure. But I ask all these things because I want to understand how they're feeling.
Yeah. When you're reading about this too, they mentioned non-classical symptoms of primary hyperparathyroidism. And it seems like the psychiatric overtones that you were just going through are some of the more non-classical symptoms. And they also mention like increased cardiovascular risk. However, they say that treatment doesn't necessarily improve those things. So they're not really sure if it's correlation or causation.
No, agreed. And just as a reminder, symptomatic, again, is officially only the bony manifestations with a fracture or having a kidney stone. Everything else is, quote unquote, asymptomatic, according to the NIH. But there are, as we are learning, more and more things that, again, some of the data is not supporting this, but that a lot of people do believe that people can be on lower antihypertensives if they have hypertension secondary or as part of their larger comorbidities, that you might see a mitigation in the decrease in your renal function over time. And so that's another thing you might see as you're looking at your patient, in this case, who's had a calcium of 10.2 for 2 years. Over time, this can affect people's renal function. And so a decreasing GFR is something that's concerning.
So let's actually talk about that, because I feel like this happens a lot where, especially precepting, where I'll see a patient who's had this sort of high riding calcium for years and years and years. I'm like, should we do something about that? And then you're the one who sort of identifies that they have primary hyperparathyroidism. And where do you go from here? So if they're asymptomatic, what are the consequences of just kind of letting things ride? Like, can you just sort of talk us through how this can go south on patients and why we'd sort of justify to them why we would worry about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, the consequences kind of mirror all the symptoms that we discussed. And I always go back to that because I think it's such an easy way to remember all the things. So stones, bones, groans, et cetera. So stones isn't just kidney stones, although yes, patients can develop kidney stones, but over time they can get nephrocalcinosis, which is when calcium deposits in the renal tubules and parenchyma, and that can affect renal function overall. And so people with longstanding hyperparathyroidism, now oftentimes they have other things going on too, and you can't say, well, your decreased renal function is solely because of this, but it likely contributes a significant amount to their renal function. So we want to avoid that. You know, we also want to avoid any complications related to kidney stones, including ones that are obstructive or require patients to have operations. I had one patient with longstanding hypercalcemia who'd had about 15 operations for kidney stones. And when I met him, he had a PICC line in for antibiotics because he developed urosepsis. So these are all, you know, that's just the kidneys. And obviously with the bones, you can have osteoporosis, you can get compression fractures of your vertebrae, you can develop other fractures in your bones. Brown tumors are something that we hear about, but we don't really see as much. And that's just developing a sort of cystic cavity in the bone over time. That's one of the ways that this used to present back in the 50s and 60s. In terms of the constipation and abdominal pain, you know, there's not like a firm end organ effect there, but sometimes people can develop pancreatitis. I think that's a little bit less common. And then we do think about, because of the renal function affecting people's, ultimately their blood pressure, and that in turn also having the hypercalcemia can cause worsening cardiovascular effects, as you mentioned earlier, Matt.
So yeah, so it's a lot of things. It's interesting how you mentioned that this used to present at a later stage because labs were not being done as often. And I think also like nowadays, any metabolic panel you order comes with a calcium, but I don't think they always used to. So maybe that was part of it too. And, you know, nowadays, I think some patients are so jaded by like, you're like, yeah, your calcium's like just a smidge high. And I think, you know, they've heard of the thyroid gland, but a lot of patients haven't heard of parathyroid. And I've had the last like 3 or 4 patients I've diagnosed with this, they've been hesitant to go see an endocrinologist, and especially knowing that they might need a surgery if we confirm the diagnosis of what they have. So it's one of those diagnoses that I feel like there's a lot out there, and there seems like there's some inertia before they get to you. That's my point.
Yeah, no, and I see that because a patient, you know, do they don't want to have a surgery? But I think especially asking them questions about how they feel, I think oftentimes then patients realize just how much this may be affecting them. And again, sometimes they are like, I feel totally fine. And either they truly are, or they just gotten used to living like this for years. But I think the important thing is, and I know we're going to talk about surgery later, the important thing is surgery is generally curative. And unlike a lot of other surgeries, which are trying to improve something, surgery is generally curative. And it's a pretty short operation overall. And I think it's a really wonderful outcome that we're able to attain for most patients.
All right, let's push this patient gently towards surgery.
Okay.
And as part of that, so before we get her there, what sort of workup should we do? So let's say the patient doesn't really give us much in the way of symptoms at all. She doesn't tell us anything worrisome, but we still would like to pursue ongoing evaluation. She's agreeable to that at least. So what is next? Do we really have to collect her urine for 24 hours? And are you absolutely sure about that? What other things should we check in on before we send her your way?
That's a great question. Honestly, the 24-hour urine testing is like my least favorite test to order for a patient because I know it is horrible to have to do. But it is really important to rule out a sort of common mimic of primary hyperparathyroidism, so familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, which again can present with mild elevations in the calcium and PTH levels because it sort of readjusts your body's natural set point by affecting the calcium sensing receptors. And importantly, because this is a sort of genetic problem, it will not be fixed with surgery. And the last thing we want to do is send a patient to surgery and have them not be fixed, which does still happen on occasion, but put them through all of that. And so the 24-hour urine calcium is really important to do expert guidelines, both from the AAES and from the Fifth International Workup, both say everyone should do it. In practice, these patients with FHH have a very long-standing history of mild hypercalcemia. So if somebody had a number of normal calciums until, you know, in this patient 2 years ago, she likely does not have that. I'm not saying you should skip it, but you'd probably be fine. But, you know, I think that's the important thing is the 24-hour urine calcium really will help rule out FHH and in some patients can also provide an indication to have surgery.
Yeah, because with FHH, the people just have like a higher set point for their normal calcium, right? And they're
basically, yeah,
they don't need a surgery. So you don't want to give somebody a surgery if they don't need it is the...
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the two guidelines give a different sort of cutoff for when you really should be worried. But I think in practice, most people use less than 100 milligrams of calcium produced in 24 hours is when you should be concerned. And then there are a couple other things that you can do. And I'm not an endocrinologist, but one is have the patient take in a calcium-rich diet, which is like 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day for 2 weeks, and then repeat the test. Alternatively, there are some newer genetic tests that are fairly not onerous because they're largely like a saliva sample that will evaluate for those mutations. Although, again, nothing is finite. We don't know every possible mutation that can exist. And that those genetic tests can also be performed if a patient has a really significant family history of primary hyperparathyroidism, or also if a patient is pretty young, because in both of those situations, you might worry about a genetic syndrome that's contributing to this. And that doesn't change necessarily their diagnosis of having primary hyperparathyroidism, but as a surgeon, it does sort of change how you approach the surgery.
Yeah, sometimes people might need a thyroid surgery and a parathyroid surgery. Are you ever doing those at the same time?
Sometimes, yes, absolutely. And depends on the indication. But sometimes if a patient has a genetic abnormality causing, say, familial hyperparathyroidism or multiple endocrine neoplasia that, you know, having primary hyperparathyroidism is a component of that, then inherently that is a four-gland problem, not a single-gland problem. And again, that just affects sort of how you approach the patient and the operation itself.
Okay. So, Paul, I guess I'll probably still let the surgeon or the endocrinologist mess with the 24-hour urine.
I think that's totally reasonable because one of the things that's like, you have to look at how much urine there was and also if it's borderline, the calcium to creatinine ratio. And I think it gets pretty like in the weeds pretty quickly with that. And I think leaving it for either the endocrinologist or somebody like myself who does this a lot to take care of it is 100% reasonable. Because especially if there's challenging cases, it's sometimes nice to have another person also to just sort of bounce ideas off of or make sure you're not missing something.
Yeah, man, I think this is the type of test where if I start thinking about it, I'm like, no, they should be seeing a specialist. Like, no.
Yeah.
I should collect 24-hour urine calcium. Like, as soon as that thought crossed my mind, I'm like, I should probably get some help here.
Yeah. I mean, Paul, you're fully smart enough to interpret it. It's just a fact of like, we don't need to order these tests very often. So it's better to go through to an office where they're set up to order it. The person looks at these tests on a regular basis. They understand the nuances of interpretation. And, you know, I think that's why.
I mean, That's a kind interpretation, but also I want somebody else to be the bad guy is really the bigger point here. I just don't want to, I'd rather have somebody else order it and I come out looking okay. Yeah, I wanted to ask Lindsay, in terms of other evaluations we should be doing, so the skeletal evaluation, since there's all these bony problems, I imagine that looks like DEXA scanning, but is there a specific area we should be focusing on, or sort of what does the bone survey look like, and then any other imaging that we might consider as we're working this patient up?
Yeah, I mean, all the patients with primary hyperparathyroidism should have a DEXA scan that involves three sites. So the femoral heads, the lumbar spine, and the distal radius, which is sort of not always included, but I think it's really helpful and is oftentimes more affected than the other sites because of cortical bone. And so the DEXA is really important because especially if a patient has osteopenia or osteoporosis, those are obviously indicators for needing surgery, which we can discuss in a moment, but also just may need to indicate that they may need additional medication help, which again is well out of my wheelhouse. If a patient is asymptomatic in terms of or doesn't have other criteria to help make the decision about recommending them for surgery, a plain film of their spine can also look for vertebral compression fractures.
In my experience, the standard DEXA comes with just the lumbar spine and the hips, and trying to order the DEXA with the VFA, the vertebral fracture analysis, the first time I ordered it, like they tried to send the patient to two different sites. It was like a mess, basically.
Yeah.
So
I broke the computer when I tried to do that.
I don't order DEXAs. So this is this is also where I refer people over to endocrinology or back to their primary care physician. Because I don't order them. I don't know how to interpret them. I certainly can't look at it and say, I'm not sure if that is totally correct or not. But a patient should get one and include the distal radius as well. I'm not sure the vertebral fracture analysis is necessary, although I do think that I think it was included in the more recent.
It is included in the guidelines. And I think it is important because, you know, because they could have asymptomatic compression fracture. So depending on where you're practicing, folks listening, you might want to just get x-rays of the spine, which we're used to ordering, and usually you'll get less pushback about that if you're, but apparently people aren't following the guidelines by ordering because there should be a lot of these ordered if people are following the guidelines. And when I tried to order it, it did not go well. So that kind of scared me off of that one.
I just don't order them at all. So that's my version of the 24-hour urine calcium.
Fair. Before we move on, in terms of any other imaging, so are we imaging the kidneys in any way to look for nephrocalcinosis or kidney stones? And should we consider parathyroid imaging at that point too?
A great question. So sort of a lot of what you guys are getting at is now that we've made our diagnosis, we're trying to evaluate how severe is this and does the patient meet surgery criteria? And I think it's helpful to separate that out into diagnosis is one thing, and that does include the 24-hour urine calcium to rule out FHH. But then the rest of it is figuring out how bad is this? And that also goes into the making the decision, should they have surgery? And I will say, as a plug for most of my surgery colleagues, we are happy to see patients who may or may not have had any part of this like workup that helps determine do they meet surgical criteria. I mean, it would be wonderful if every patient who walked in my office came in like perfectly packaged form, but I'm always happy also to have a conversation with any patient who may be reluctant to have surgery, who hasn't had all the workup, and I can kind of work on things and then have a discussion with the patient as well. Because sometimes having the discussion with the surgeon about what everything involves, or just having a discussion with somebody who deals with this a lot, can be really helpful for a patient. So the things that go into making the decision to recommend a patient for surgery kind of, again, overlap a little bit. But I think it's important to talk about the guidelines for a moment before we get into talking about the workup or go return to talking about the workup a little bit more. So any patient who is quote unquote symptomatic should have surgery. So then by that, it is any patient with a kidney stone, like a symptomatic kidney stone, basically any patient who has significant osteoporosis that may have already been noted, or a compression fracture, or osteitis fibrosis cystica, which people don't even really image for that anymore, but it's included still as in symptomatic. All of those patients should have surgery. And they don't necessarily need everything else, although, again, having a DEXA, et cetera, is really helpful. For patients who are otherwise, quote unquote, asymptomatic, and maybe their biggest symptom is their fatigue or their memory issues and some constipation, doing all these other things, again, can be helpful because it can identify potential problems or identify perhaps some silent kidney stones or nephrocalcinosis that the patient may not be aware of, and that will create an indication for surgery. And so I think it's really important to help figure out does the patient need surgery, or do they want surgery, and would they benefit from surgery? And all these things go into that. There are other guideline criteria as well. So I know I'm sort of talking in circles a little bit, but anyone who has, who's overtly symptomatic, and then anyone who has is starting to sort of have other end organ sequela. So a GFR of less than 60, silent kidney stones or nephrocalcinosis. So those are all of the renal involvements. Anyone who maybe have had like a silent fracture, and obviously osteoporosis I mentioned earlier. Most endocrine surgeons will also operate for osteopenia, although that is not officially in any of the guidelines, but most of us see it as a pit stop on the way to osteoporosis. So why wait? So we'll oftentimes do that. A significantly elevated calcium, so greater than 1 milligram per deciliter above the upper limit of normal, is another indicator, because that just means the problem is sort of getting worse and they can be more and more likely to experience other significant side effects. The urinary calcium, which we already ordered, the 24-hour, if they have an elevated urinary calcium, so for women, greater than 250 milligrams in 24 hours, and for men, greater than 300, because those are both highly concerning for possible kidney stone formation. And last but not least, age less than 50. And there's no data that supports age less than 50. It is just sort of what everyone's agreed upon. But the idea being that if you are this young, you will develop a lot of these problems over time. That said, I've never turned anyone away because they were 51 or 54. And these are all sort of, again, guidelines, and not every patient fits into guidelines. And so other things include, according to the endocrine surgery guidelines, but not in the fifth international workup, somebody who has significant neuropsychiatric side effects, somebody who has significant cardiovascular issues may also benefit early on. And like any patient also who either just really wants surgery, and any patient who's really unable to follow up with any surveillance with yearly labs that may happen if they decide to not have surgery at this time. So really, and I oftentimes see patients who don't fit into a hard criteria, but who are very desirous of having this problem fixed. And I'm certainly not going to say no to them.
Our episode today is sponsored by Panacea Financial, a nationwide digital bank built for doctors by doctors. Founded by two Meds Peds doctors, Panacea Financial was designed to help whether you're a medical student, a resident, fellow, or an attending. Panacea Financial can help with anything from personal loans to high-yield savings accounts, and can even help you navigate practice ownership opportunities. Rather than taking on high-interest credit card debt, Panacea Financial's Pay-Run personal loan gives you a better way to cover expenses like relocation, board exams, or debt consolidation. Did you know their Pay-Run loans have interest rates less than half the average credit card rate, no cosigner requirement, and no prepayment penalties? Well, now you do. Also, Panacea's practice financing team supports physicians by helping you start, acquire, expand, or even buy into a practice or a surgery center. If you're ready to join the thousands of doctors who've declared independence from traditional banks, visit PanaceaFinancial.com today. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC.
And your point about the osteopenia or the low bone density, and you know that being an indication, it kind of makes sense that like if we're operating because people are young and that means they have a longer lead time to develop problems, then operating earlier in the course of the low bone density disease makes sense.
Absolutely. And the data doesn't necessarily support overall decreased fracture risk after parathyroidectomy, but there will be an increase in bone mineral density after parathyroidectomy. And so it's like time is bone, basically, in both directions. And so why wait for it to get worse before you can try to make it better? Why not just stop it early on? So again, not officially in the guidelines, but most endocrine surgeons will operate for osteopenia.
Okay. So we have our criteria for the operation. Paul, anything else we need to get to before we get to the next part of the case here?
I guess I would like to ask about the flip side of the coin in terms of who's the patient that, you know, it's not our job to convince anyone of anything, but like say someone is hesitant to consider surgery, are there patients that are appropriate just for observation or for just medical management as much as possible? Like who doesn't get operated on?
So, I mean, that's a little hard for me to answer in the sense that I don't really see those patients. But, you know, yes. I think it's, and so I actually was doing some prep for today, and it's really anyone who does, technically doesn't meet any of the guideline criteria. So maybe they are 75 and they are totally asymptomatic and have no issues. And they're like, well, why? And, you know, it's a good question because why, if you feel pretty good and there's nothing wrong with you, like in terms of hard facts about your medical conditions, then it's hard to say you're going to make somebody better with the surgery. So really those are the criteria. And oftentimes, yes, patients don't want to do what we often may recommend to them. because it's not right for them at that moment in time. And so then as long as they can maintain yearly surveillance with labs, and then anything getting worse would be a really strong indicator that they really need to be referred for surgery.
Yeah, Paul, I can give two examples from my panel that just stand out as, like, one was a guy in his 60s who didn't meet any of the criteria and he didn't want to get a surgery. And, you know, he just wants us to monitor his bone density was normal. He didn't have kidney stones or anything else going on. And then another was a 96-year-old guy. I'm very convinced he had symptoms and his calcium was like 11 and change, but he didn't want to. He's like, I'm 96. I'm not going to get a surgery. So,
yeah. And I think, and I have definitely seen patients like that who are not 96 entirely, but 84, and who probably should have had surgery. They were, you know, sort of told maybe, maybe not, or you have a lot of other comorbidities, so it's not worthwhile. And I will say the difficulty part with that assessment is that people aren't going to get healthier over time, right? And so oftentimes I'll have a patient sitting in my office who's like, well, they have a guideline criteria and they're a little symptomatic, but they're like, oh, I don't know. And I will say to them, you know, I'm not getting younger, you're not getting younger, and I'd rather make sure we can help you now before things get worse for this problem and before maybe you have other things going on that would actually make anesthesia and surgery riskier. And that's kind of my approach, because I have seen the negative of people waiting too long. I had an 84-year-old woman who'd had this for a long time. I don't know what the conversations were because she was in a different health system, but, you know, was essentially bedbound and had had like 3 hospital admissions for hypercalcemic crisis in the preceding 3 months. She had a humerus fracture. She like didn't eat, so she was constantly getting dehydrated. She didn't eat because she had abdominal pain, so she got dehydrated, made the hypercalcemia worse, you know. And I would have had rather, if I had, you know, been in practice taking care of the woman 5 years ago or ideally 10 years ago, as opposed to when she's 84 and her 4th admission for a hypercalcemic crisis is looming. So I think those are really tough calls and being like, well, who shouldn't have surgery? And I think it's always a great opportunity to still engage your local endocrine surgeon, even on the side, say, hey, what do you think about this case? Because sometimes people will say, no, this is totally fine. And sometimes they'll say, oh, my goodness, I really need to help this person sooner rather than later.
No, I don't want to dwell on this too long. But like, that was a lot of the impetus for this episode is just, I feel like patients are at least out the discussion. Like, I feel like this is something that I see that is just sort of monitored quietly in the background without even maybe a conversation. And I'm like, hey, and you know, you have this primary hyperparathyroidism too. And patients are like, what now? And it's just, it's not, and you may not do anything with it, but you should at least have the conversation. I think in this era of open charts with like chronic kidney disease as a diagnosis showing up and people are like, what is this? Like, it's just something that we should preempt and talk about rather than assume that no one wants to do anything about it.
Totally agree, because it may be affecting all these other things. And
yeah. All right.
Before we go on to the next part of her discussion, I think we wanted to just get a sense of like, when do you suspect parathyroid carcinoma?
Yeah, great question. So that is something that I suspect in a patient who has an extremely high calcium level, like 16, 17, maybe they've been admitted to the hospital for hypercalcemia crisis. That's usually what happens. And then you suspect it because then their PTH in conjunction with that is usually very elevated. So normally we think about in terms of picograms per milliliter as our range, 15 to 65 or so is normal. Again, every hospital uses a slightly different lab and it's all a little bit off. But, you know, I'll typically see people who have a parathyroid hormone level in the 70s to 150s, maybe 200s. The carcinoma patients have a calcium that's against 16 or 17 and a PTH that's more like 700, 800 without having renal failure, because that's a common number to see in patients who are on end-stage renal disease, right? So that's the other thing. But also if they've had a recent normal calcium. I don't mean recent like last week. I mean recent like in the last year or two, because this is something that typically happens very quickly. It's not something that just necessarily builds up over time. And so that those are the patients I will worry about. That said, parathyroid carcinoma is a sort of a diagnosis you make almost more intraoperatively based upon local invasion to the surrounding tissues, and particularly the thyroid. And so I will have a conversation oftentimes with patients saying like, this could be a carcinoma, which I gotta say, I've never actually had one. I just have some patients who just had no medical care and came into the hospital feeling horrible. And they're, you know, kind of presented like this. And they just had a very large and maybe cystic degenerating parathyroid gland and not a carcinoma. But that's something that I have to worry about. And then I have to talk to the patient about this could be the case, in which case I will be more aggressive in my surgery. but it all is just more like intraoperative suspicion. But if you have that patient who shows up to your office, or if you are inpatient on the inpatient side, and that's the person you're admitting from the emergency room, that's sort of something that needs to get dealt very urgently. That's not the can see endocrinology in 3 months patient. That's the patient who needs surgery in the next couple of weeks.
Paul, I don't think I'm missing a lot of parathyroid carcinoma.
You know, it's incredibly, incredibly rare. And I've had more patients present like that one patient I mentioned where they just had no medical care. And so no records to show that maybe they've had hypercalcemia for 15 years and it suddenly just evolved. And we don't know why that happens to some people, but it's incredibly rare.
So to move it on here, if we were going to send Ms. Jones to see you, you know, I know that there are some parathyroid imaging studies that can be done. I don't think I've ordered one. Yeah, I don't think I've ever ordered one. I don't know, Paul, have you? Are you ordering these?
No.
And that's fine. And I think especially if you have a person you work with often for these or, you know, on occasion for these patients, I think asking them what they prefer is probably the best way to go. The American Association of Endocrine Surgery guidelines say that every patient should have a thyroid ultrasound, well, a neck ultrasound, but one that's going to look at the central neck, which is where the thyroid and parathyroid are located. And that is because actually what you want to be looking for is concurrent thyroid nodular disease, which is far more common in the general population than primary hyperparathyroidism. And the last thing you really want to do as a surgeon is pop in there and realize that there's some sort of like horrible malignancy in the thyroid that you weren't prepared to address, et cetera. This is a sort of like ongoing little debate within the endocrine surgery world. Some people are like, you don't need that. And some people are like, everyone should. I fall into the everyone should category because I like to be, I'm still young in my career, relatively, although I'm getting older every day, and I want to be prepared. So if I had my druthers, every patient would already have a neck ultrasound when I saw them, just because that way, if they have a thyroid nodule, I can just tell them that right away. We'll get them biopsied and kind of get the everything moving more quickly. But if they don't, that is fine too. So a neck ultrasound is what every patient should have. That may or may not show the abnormal gland or glands. And if it doesn't, it's not an indication that you should or should not have surgery. I think that's a really important thing, that the absence of seeing an abnormal parathyroid gland on imaging is not a contraindication to surgery. So nobody should let that factor into their decision. And I love that we're coming on this part after we've already discussed diagnosis and evaluating a patient for surgery or not, because it should not factor into that discussion. And that's something that I, you know, see very oftentimes. I will see a patient who's maybe seen a different clinician for quite some time and they did an ultrasound and they didn't see anything on there. And they were like, well, you shouldn't have surgery. And that's simply not the case, because the ultrasound is not going to be as good at looking for the parathyroid glands as other imaging sources, including, and this is one of those obnoxious surgeon sayings, but like the only imaging you really need is a good parathyroid surgeon, which is true.
Maybe the most surgical phrase ever said out loud. I love it.
But you know, that's something that the residents sometimes will say as they're like starting to work with me. They'll be like, well, I want to get the imaging, then we'll figure out if they should have surgery or not. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. My impression was that the imaging sounded almost like it's like a test to maybe help localize which gland is most likely that you're going to take out, right? Because you're doing a lot of searching, right? Like you're not sure if you're going to dissect both sides of the neck and which gland
Absolutely.
You're going to go for.
Yeah, the imaging, I say this to the patients, the imaging is a guide to me, but if it doesn't show anything that does not change my plan to do surgery, mm-hmm. it just changes sort of how I start. And so the ultrasound, again, is helpful for the thyroid, to evaluate for the thyroid disease. And then after that, every surgeon has his or her own preference. I personally like a four-dimensional CT scan, which is a special phase of contrast CT scan that both looks at sort of enhancement and washout of thyroid and parathyroid glands, which you'll only see if they are enlarged. Some people prefer a SPECT CT or any other sort of like nuclear medicine scan, which is more of a functional imaging study. And everyone has their different preferences based on what they're comfortable with, based on what's locally available. So where I work now, they did not really do a lot of 4D CTs. And then that's what I really trained with in fellowships. When I started, I met with some of the radiologists and asked, like, can we be doing this instead? And they were like, sure. And that's just been really great because it's my preferred modality. But every surgeon is going to be a little bit different in terms of what they want, which is why I think by no means does anyone before the surgeon need to be ordering this or even interpreting it.
That's reassuring. I don't need more work to do, Paul. I'm not sure how you feel about it.
Well, no, then you get the results back and what you do with them. It's just a whole thing. So yeah, we'll leave that for the surgeons. Mm-hmm. So Lindsay, can you talk us through, what the surgery actually looks like itself. So the patient's in the OR. We have the single best diagnostic tool in the world, which is an endocrine surgeon's eyeballs.
There you go.
So when you're in the neck, talk us through what that looks like for the patient, just the broad strokes, just because I'm interested.
Absolutely. So this is an operation in the operating room, and patients are fully anesthetized with an endotracheal tube placed. This can, in some circumstances, be done under local anesthesia, but I would say that that's much less common and not sort of the standard, but 100% doable. But I would not necessarily, again, say that to a patient that that's what they would expect. So the patient's fully asleep with anesthesia, with their arms tucked at their sides and their chin tilted back, basically, so their neck is extended. And then based upon if there is preoperative imaging that maybe suggests an abnormal gland is when one place, the surgeon will make an incision. The textbooks will all say like 2 fingers breadths above the sternal notch. I make my incision based on where I think the parathyroid gland may be, or frankly, in a patient's skin crease if they have one, because then it will hide better. At some point before working in the central neck, either before surgery or before working in that specific area of the neck, a baseline parathyroid hormone level is drawn. And again, there's a variety of ways that this can get done, but basically you want to get a baseline level for that day. And then the surgeon will use any preoperative imaging that suggests maybe the gland is in one place or another. Maybe they'll start there. I think this, not to get too much into the nitty gritty of the surgery, but inherently, no matter, even if your imaging suggests maybe one gland is abnormal, there's always the possibility that all four are. 80% of patients with primary hyperparathyroidism have a single gland that's abnormal or a single adenoma. About 7 to 10% have two adenomas, and if so, most commonly the bilateral uppers. Another 7 to 10% have all four glands that are slightly abnormal. They're hyperplastic. And so the imaging is, again, it's a guide, but you cannot rely solely on that. And so there's a variety of different things that surgeons will do in terms of their sort of intraoperative mental algorithm. But fundamentally, you want to be making sure you are taking out everything that needs to be removed. So everything that's abnormal, whether it's one gland, two glands, or if it's all four, 3.5 glands. And at the conclusion of that, you want to be checking another parathyroid hormone level, usually 3, over a period of like usually 5, 10, 15 minutes apart. Everyone does this, again, a little bit differently. There's no one standard. But the idea is that you want to see your parathyroid hormone level come down by at least 50% and into the normal range. The half-life of the parathyroid hormone is about 3 to 4 minutes. So if you are waiting 5 or 10 minutes to do your draw, you really should see it come down to normal right away. And that really should tell you that what you've done is a thorough surgery. So if I think the patient only has one abnormal gland and I were to just take that one out and not check a level, it's possible they could have multiple. And then I would have failed that surgery for that patient. So the surgeon's job is to be thorough and to use whatever adjuncts, whether it's looking for all four glands and using parathyroid hormone monitoring or using some other sort of complex experience that, we don't need to get too much into the nitty gritty, but usually using parathyroid hormone monitoring is really the standard. Some people will use a gamma probe and will inject like a radiolabel tracer before the surgery. That's a little bit less common. But the idea is that you want to know that you're curing the patient, because any reoperative surgery is much more challenging.
That's pretty cool. The intraoperative surgery is kind of the coolest. PTH monitoring is really
cool. It is really cool. Some people use a gamma probe instead of PTH monitoring. There are definitely, if you Google, some people who feel very strongly about that technique. I would say it's not the standard. Much not to say it doesn't work, but it is not what's commonly done, nor is it the only option. But usually people will do the PTH monitoring, because that will really tell you how successful you've been, which is, again, part of we were talking about earlier about like why, falling in love with endocrine surgery. And it's really because you can see right away, was I successful at fixing this problem? Which is sometimes if it's a single gland and I knew exactly where it was and I operate for about 20 minutes and then it's waiting for the levels to come back. And it's really gratifying to cure a patient in 20 minutes of a problem that may be contributing significantly to their overall health and the quality of life on a daily basis.
What about the post-op monitoring of this? Mm-hmm. I know hypocalcemia is an issue. So what are you looking for, and how frequent are you monitoring? Are the patients staying over in the hospital for this?
Yeah, great questions. So I would say most commonly at this point in time, people are sending their patients home same day after a parathyroid surgery. The incision itself is pretty small. Sending people home on opioid medications is increasingly less common. I have actually never done it because most patients don't need it. And the incision, it's like, I know I'm on maybe on YouTube at one point, but the incision's usually only a couple of centimeters in size. So that it's not super uncomfortable for patients. Mm-hmm. They oftentimes will have a sore throat, but I say patients can go back to normal eating and drinking as they feel able. The hypocalcemia is really the most concerning thing, and that will really happen over a period of about 48 hours until the calcium truly reaches its nadir. There is no one set recommendation in terms of how you either care for a patient like that or you prevent that from happening. Some people will use the patient's PTH level at the end of the operation to judge how much calcium to send them home on. I personally send people home on calcium and vitamin D with a certain weaning regimen, just because that is just sort of what works best for my practice and my patients. But there is no one way to do it. We do have to have a conversation with patients about what hypocalcemia feels like and what to do. And that typically starts by manifesting itself, again, usually no earlier than 48 hours after surgery, but with perioral paresthesias and also digital paresthesias, so numbness and tingling. And after that, it can progress to muscle cramping and weakness and eventually tetany, which hopefully that never happens. But really in that situation, you want to be telling the patient, take a bunch more calcium if they have some already, which is why I think it's helpful to always send them with some. Tums is also a really nice over-the-counter calcium alternative, extra strength or ultra strength. If they've had bariatric surgery or on an antacid medication, calcium citrate is also over-the-counter. Take some calcium. It should get better. But if it really doesn't or you can't get calcium, just go to the emergency room. Again, incredibly uncommon if you are, you know, taking care of these patients frequently and you know how to prepare them for this and how to prevent that from happening. But it does happen.
Is it days or weeks or months that they're on this regimen, the tapering regimen?
When I send people home, I send them home on a regimen for probably 15 days, which is weaning down to nothing over a period of 15 days, which is probably overkill for some people. My theory, and again, people might mock me for this, but my theory is I'd rather people be a little bit hypercalcemic for a little bit longer than be hypocalcemic, which can be life-threatening. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if I do a surgery and it's not curative, I'm not sending them home on something. And that is the other risk related to this, is that anywhere from about 5-7% of patients across the country, depending on what data set you look at, and for high volume endocrine surgeons like myself, it's typically a lot lower than 5%. But the surgeon will not be able to find one or more abnormal glands and the problem will not go away. And you do know that in real time when you're doing that, because your hormone level doesn't drop. And it is a possibility. And it happens even if the imaging shows one abnormal gland or something. And so that's the other risk that I counsel patients on. But obviously, then I don't send them home on calcium.
Okay. So for Miss Jones, Paul, are we ready to give her a happy ending here? She gets her surgery. Let's say we find one abnormal gland, levels go down to normal intraoperatively. So we've cured her. We send her on her 15 days of calcium and vitamin D tapering.
And I like this use of the royal we, Matt. That's nice.
And she does great. Yeah. Well, we're going to take credit for this, Paul.
Yeah,
come on.
We're part of the team. Absolutely.
You are. You found the problem. Because that's honestly one of the bigger things, is identifying a problem. So.
And we did something about it, Paul. We did the 24-hour urine collection for this patient.
I'm maybe the best doctor. You're right. Thank you.
Okay. So the last thing that I wanted to ask about, last but not least, Lindsay, is this. I had never heard of normocalcemic primary hypoparathyroidism, but Paul and I were both saying we think we've seen this before because, you know, maybe we started checking parathyroid because they had one calcium that was a little bit high, but then their calcium goes back to normal, but their PTH remains high. So what is this?
So there are actually two variants of classic primary hyperparathyroidism. And these are can be very difficult to diagnose. And this is always something where I personally oftentimes will find it helpful with especially normocalcemic disease to work with an endocrinologist. So we'll tackle normocalcemic first. And normocalcemic is what it sounds like. You have a normal calcium level, but an elevated parathyroid hormone level. And that can be really difficult to distinguish from secondary hyperparathyroidism, which is also characterized by a normal calcium level and an elevated parathyroid hormone level. And you have to really, at that point in time, think about things that can be contributing to secondary hyperparathyroidism, like a low vitamin D level, renal insufficiency, any sort of malabsorption issue. And again, this is really 100% where you work with an endocrinologist, because, you know, I'm a surgeon. I don't have the long-term patience for doing all this long-term medications and lab checking. But that is typically what needs to happen, is sort of ruling every possible thing out. And typically these patients will have a calcium level that's in like the upper nines, not the low nines, and certainly not the eights. once you've identified that these patients do have normal calcemic primary hyperparathyroidism, it's the same surgical criteria and the same sort of the same surgery. These patients will typically have a higher rate of potentially having multiple abnormal glands. And so you do have to counsel them on that. And then kind of going along with that, a higher rate of operative failure. The other variant is normal hormonal primary hyperparathyroidism, which again is what it sounds like, which is when, and I see this a lot more often, I think it's a lot easier to diagnose, but it's when you have an elevated calcium and the parathyroid hormone level is inappropriately normal. So again, it's not suppressed. Yeah. So instead of, again, if you have high calcium level, your parathyroid hormone level should be at or below normal, which for me is about 20 to 15 is a lower end of normal. Anything that's in the 30s and 40s and certainly 50s is inappropriately normal. And that just means your parathyroid hormone is not being suppressed. So in those cases, that is, again, that is still primary hyperparathyroidism. Somehow the set point is, again, still a little bit off. We don't know, like, do these patients eventually evolve into having classic disease? We don't truly know that. But they do can't have the same end organ sequelae as the classic patients. And they should also have surgery if indicated by the same guidelines. And I know what I appreciate that I think like LabCorp and Quest, the lab companies we often use, will come back and they'll show if you have a PTH and a calcium that you draw together as part of an order, they'll come back and say primary hyperparathyroidism, secondary, tertiary. And I think that's really helpful in some ways, but I think it can be misleading because if your parathyroid hormone level is just under the upper limit of normal, it may say, oh, that's not hyperparathyroidism, but really it is. And again, thanks to the availability of lab tests, we are seeing these patients more and more and more, and they have the same long-term consequences. So I think it's really important to identify them, but also really challenging to identify them.
So for the audience, if they see somebody with high calcium and inappropriately normal PTH or normal calcium and high PTH, and we can't find any secondary causes for that high PTH, then those patients should be worked up just like we would work up primary hyperparathyroidism with high calcium and high PTH. So we'd be doing the same kind of studies and the same kind of criteria for surgery.
Absolutely. And again, this is an area where if I ever have concerns or confusion, I 100% work with my friendly endocrinologist because they are so helpful and so thoughtful about so many different things that are nuances that maybe I'm not as familiar with.
Paul, are we ready for take-home points?
I think we're ready for take-home points. So, Lindsay, anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with specifically? So what take-home points should the internist listening to the show take away from you, our endocrine surgeon? Yeah.
I think any hypercalcemia that's chronic is just not normal. Even if it's just at the upper limit of normal, maybe sometimes it dips down underneath the upper limit of normal. But over time, it's really not normal and really should get looked at because this patient may have a problem that can be cured. And maybe they don't have a problem that could be cured, but, you know, something to look at because, you know, and I have no idea how you all check the 15 gajillion results you have for every patient and you squeeze that into your increasingly short visit times that we're all made to abide by. But I know, you know, it's something that if you're seeing it and it raises a red flag on the inside, just keep going with that.
Okay. And I think lastly, but not leastly, anything that you'd like to plug?
Find your friendly local endocrine surgeon. We are all very friendly. We're a very friendly specialty. We all feel very nerdy and loving with these specific disease processes. Like I could talk about this all day long. But there are a lot of endocrine surgeons. And I think we take really great care of our patients because we care so much about this problem, not just the surgery itself, but we care about truly nothing is better than a patient walking into my office. I did a really great surgery on them. Maybe it was frustrating in the moment, but they tell me that they feel so much better, you know, or when their wife calls me and says, we were on a road trip and we didn't have to stop every 45 minutes for my husband to use the bathroom. Like that's just the little ways in which you can really make somebody's life and their spouse's life and everything else so much better are just so gratifying. And we endocrine surgeons really love these problems. So please, we'd love to work with you.
Fantastic.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge So we want your feedback. You can email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. You can also subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Wanted to give a special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.